Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Kate Loving and the Collective Wisdom. My name is Kate Loving Shank of katelovingshank.com and the author of the Prayer Prescription Series. In fact, the Prayer Prescription Series is the sponsor of this show. My guest this evening is Eric Mazel, author of his most recent book called Making Your Creative Mark, 9 Keys to Achieving Your Artistic Goals. Eric has written at least 20 books for artists. I am almost finished reading one of his other books called Rethinking Depression, which is very important for artists to understand as well. I would say please join me in welcoming Eric. He was here on the switchboard, but he has disappeared. I'm just wondering when he will be back. But I have really enjoyed reading the book called Making Your Creative Mark, and the 9 keys have to do with the artist's relationship with all kinds of different variables in life itself. Please join me in welcoming Eric Mazel. Hello, Eric.
Hi, Kate. A little bit of an adventure getting here, but nice to talk to you.
I know. Isn't that funny? I love reading. I've read now 2 of your books. I'm almost finished with Rethinking Depression, but I was wondering, why did you write this particular book now when you've written so many books for artists, I gather about over 20 at least? What is it that you feel that artists need to know now that you have that you are portraying in your book?
Well, the issues never end and the challenges never end. And as I continue working with clients, both individually and in groups and worldwide, mm-hmm. I keep hearing the same issues returning. So I wanted to present even more practical strategies for dealing with negative self-talk, survival in the marketplace, confidence, all kinds of issues that keep returning. So I've talked about many of these things before. We start in the book with the mind key, and I've talked about how to be a better friend mentally in many other books. But in this book, I wanted to add some more practical advice and sort of keep the discussion going, because these issues don't go away, and they're just tremendously important.
That's right. The relationship that we all must have with ourselves is probably the very first thing that needs to be addressed, wouldn't you say?
It is, and because creative people are often smart people, they get in the habit of believing that rational thoughts ought to be countenanced. True thoughts ought to be countenanced. If you have a true thought, you should take that seriously, and in fact, that's not necessarily true. If you have a thought like, boy, there are a lot of writers out there, that's a true thought, but it's also the kind of thought that can sabotage you and block you and cause you not to want to go on.
Mm-hmm.
So I suggest that people think only thoughts that serve them, as opposed to true or false thoughts. The truth of a thought isn't so important. It's whether a thought really serves you. And the thoughts that serve us are, I'm showing up, I'm doing the work, I'm going to get my work out there, I'm befriending my work, I'm going to prove the exception. There are lots of thoughts that serve us, and there are lots of true thoughts, like there are so many writers out there, or there's so much competition, or whatever, that don't serve us.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, in other words, artists tend to sabotage themselves and their success by feeling that, by getting swayed by what they see might be true when it really isn't. I mean, they're not dealing
right.
with the balance, their own balance as an artist.
Well,
and,
we're tricky mm-hmm. creatures, you know, we're pretty tricky creatures, and we say things to ourselves to help us avoid doing the hard work of creating. The two most common things we say nowadays are, I'm too tired and I'm too busy. And because those sound so true, because there are so many grains of truth in those utterances, we let ourselves off the hook. So we have to attach a big but to those and say, I am tired, but I can put in half an hour on my novel, or I am busy, but I can carve out some time for my painting. We can't let our trickiness undo us, because there's a part of us that doesn't want to do the work, because the work is harder than sitting down and watching TV. You know, the work's harder than that. So because it's hard, we want to find ways to avoid it. And because it's not just hard, sometimes we're hating the work. You know, if you're writing a novel for 2 years, and what is that, 700 plus days, there may be 300 or 400 days where you're hating the book. You know, where you don't know what to do next, and you just wish the villain would come alive and blah, blah, blah. And it's really hard to go do your work on days when you hate it. So one of the things we have to do, and I talk about the devotion key, one of the things we have to do is love our work even when we hate it, which may sound paradoxical, but it's really just an attitude. It's a decision to be for our work and to understand that there are going to be times when we're really not liking it, but we have to, and sort of like kids, there may be times when we don't really like our kids, but we still need to love them and take care of them and support them and be good to them. We need to be good to our work even on days when we're not liking it.
Well, and you had made the distinction or the correlation between the word devotion and discipline, where people think they beat themselves up if they're not being, quote, disciplined, when in reality, by replacing that word with devotion and passion, I think people can break through those blocks easier.
Yeah. I'm not sure if it's replacing the word or it's actually finding the devotion and the passion.
You have to do that for sure.
Yeah, that's Pavarotti's quote. Pavarotti said, people say I'm disciplined and it's not discipline, it's devotion, and there's a big difference. And there is a big difference, because it's really hard to white-knuckle your work. If you're only writing a book or painting out of discipline, you're going to stop doing it at some point, because it's not going to feel like it matters enough to you just to be, so to speak, proving that you can be disciplined. You're actually doing it because you're seeing the creating as a meaning opportunity. It's one of the ways you make meaning, and you want to be devoted to your own meaning opportunities. And that's the way we make ourselves proud, and it's the way we generate the psychological experience of meaning in life. So it's way more than just turning out another photograph or song. It's how we make meaning in life. And if we don't do that, we're going to experience a meaning crisis.
Yeah, when people say to you or to the artist, oh, my gosh, you're so disciplined, it's like their way of saying, well, I'm not disciplined, so I couldn't do that.
That's exactly right. And most artists, you know, if you look at them, you look at Pavarotti himself, you can tell he wasn't all that disciplined. So many artists are not disciplined they're not disciplined people. We have outsized appetites often, and which is a great thing, because we have appetites for life and appetites for doing our work. But we also have, you know, appetites for peanuts and cocaine and sex and this, that, and the other thing. That's why so many of our most creative people are also alcoholics or alcoholics in recovery or what have you, because we have these appetites. And it's not so hard to be disciplined. It's not so easy to be disciplined when you have all of these appetites, and we have them.
So obviously people, as you mentioned several times in your book, do need to go through recovery. If these are a so-called problem or challenge, because you just can't live with those kinds of addictions, they will kill you. So
no, they have to come first.
Yeah, that's right.
Unfortunately, or fortunately, whatever, whether it's fortunate or unfortunate, if your life has been derailed by an addiction, you have to take that seriously and put that on the top of your list. And there are a lot of consequences of entering into recovery, obviously good consequences of no longer being so caught up in the use of some drug or behavior. But one of the things that you have to remember in early recovery is to maybe not set so ambitious an agenda for your creative life, because in early recovery, you're trying to keep yourself calm in a certain sense. You're trying to do the first things first in one day at a time work. Mm-hmm. And when you put a big creative project on the table, you turn on your life force and energies and ambitions, and you kind of rev yourself up in a way that runs a little counter to the task of being calm and being in recovery. So in the very early recovery, in the first weeks, months, it's really smart to tailor your creative work, to be modest about your creative work, and not set yourself your most ambitious projects.
That makes sense. It just becomes too distracting and too frightening. Too much going
you
on
in a way
at once.
That's right. In a way, you come too alive, and you not exactly want to be alive at that moment. You want to be careful, more careful than alive in early recovery.
Right, right. I had a situation. One of my very closest friends disappeared for 15 years. He's an artist. He disappeared for 15 years, and it turned out he was hospitalized for major depression. And I know that in your book, Making Your Creative Mark, you do mention the book Rethinking Depression.
Mm-hmm.
And as artists, I think that that we are all, well, first of all, the premise that depression exists is what you are confronting head on in that book. So when he got out of the hospital, and we found out he was alive, and thank God for that, he is writing plays and he's back to his art. But there's such a thing about depression in our society. It's just hooked up, as you say, with the mental health people, with the pharmaceutical industry, with the medical industry, and why people just dole out drugs as opposed to sitting and talking to people is because it doesn't really pay and all this and that. So can you tell us how artists fall prey to this depression label and how they can relinquish and become free from it?
It's a super large question, and it's a question that's of real moment in the world at this split second. You may or may not know that the manual that therapists use to diagnose, that psychiatrists, psychologists, family therapists use to diagnose, it's called the DSM, Diagnostic and Statistical Manual,
mm-hmm.
gets revised periodically. And the new one, the DSM-5, was to come out this month. I think it's been delayed because of the super negative feedback around all the new mental disorders that have been created by folks sitting around the table. And so there's a lot of controversy about the DSM-5. In my work, in both the book Rethinking Depression, and I'm writing for a global telesummit on diagnostic alternatives, and I'm writing for a big massive conversation on the DSM. So I'm in this world right at this second. From
mm-hmm.
my point of view, the DSM changes are not the problem. The whole DSM is a problem.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's a catalog. It's like a Christmas catalog for buying, for shopping, for therapists shopping for diagnosis, and rather than a true manual. A true manual would speak to causes of mental disorders, which the DSM doesn't, and treatments of mental disorders, which the DSM doesn't. The DSM is just a certain kind of catalog. So I'm saying a lot as background. There's no such thing as depression until there's a definition of mental disorder that makes any sense. If you go
mm-hmm.
read the American Psychiatric Association's definition of mental disorder, you will just shake your head and say, what in God's name are they talking about? I believe that depression is monetized sadness. We have a lot of sadness. Why wouldn't we have sadness? If we don't like our
mm-hmm.
job, if we're trying to write, but we have to do a day job 60 hours a week, if we're also not in a relationship because we're spending all of our time in the studio and we want to be in the studio, but we also want to be in a relationship, but we don't want to be out of the studio, if nothing we're doing is selling, if our car doesn't run and we don't have health insurance and this, why wouldn't we be sad? What's
right.
surprising about such a person being sad chronically and deeply? So
mm-hmm.
there's lots of chronic and deep sadness in the arts, including and especially, and I did another book called The Van Gogh Blues on the following, especially existential sadness, namely sadness around wondering if we or our efforts actually matter. Who needs another photograph? Who needs another poem? Why are we doing this as opposed to something, quote, more important, unquote?
Mm-hmm.
So there's
mm-hmm.
a lot of existential sadness along with all kinds of circumstantial sadness in the lives of creative people. It's a huge problem to relabel it as depression and provide chemical, not medication, but chemicals for the treatment of this newly labeled whatever it is, doesn't do human beings any service.
Well, as you were saying in your book, it's a matter of treating so-called symptoms as opposed to really getting to the cause of what is going on in a person.
That's right. Let's forget about who the person is. If you come into a certain kind of office and you say, my hands are rough, you know, and I immediately give you medication without asking if maybe you're a bricklayer or a drummer, as opposed to whether you have a rash, I should be asking you some questions about
right.
what the sources of the symptom might be, as opposed to just taking the symptom as a self-report and giving you a medication or a chemical as a direct response to your announcing a symptom. That's not the way symptoms work in real medicine. The symptoms are related to something going on underneath. We act like there's nothing going on underneath, or it's not necessary to know what's going on underneath. Just give me a symptom and I'll find a chemical for you. And that's not the way medicine operates, and that's not the way a mental health industry should operate.
Well, that kind of reminds me of the time I took my dog to the vet, and the dog had obviously had mange, and the dog a day or two before had rolled on a dead fox that looked like he had, like the fox looked like it had mange. So I did tell this to the veterinarian, and he ignored the fact that the dog had, felt, it was obvious, it was a cause and effect, it was right there, but he just treated the dog in a way that had nothing to do with mange. And I think that kind of says it all for what we're just talking about.
That's right.
Nobody's listening and nobody's taking a history.
That's right. That's right. When even, so to speak, real doctors, aren't listening, how much less are, I mean, think for a second of the following really odd situation. People with no medical training, family therapists, I'm one of them, family therapists, psychologists, licensed social workers, etc., people with no medical training are by law granted the responsibility for diagnosing and treating mental disorders.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
It's really odd that they should be given that right, because it's such a medical sounding task with zero medical training. How can they be allowed to do that? Well, they can be allowed to do it because no one is really believing that under the surface is a medical issue or a biological issue. No one's actually believing that. And nevertheless, these disorders are being treated as if they were biological. They're being treated with chemicals that have strong biological effects as if the underlying cause was biological, when in fact
mm-hmm.
nobody actually believes that it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, not even the doctors.
Not even the psychiatrists. There are interesting numbers about how much less time over the years they've become accustomed to spending talking to their patients, because the talk's unnecessary. If you know if you know that as soon as I self-report sadness, you're going to call it depression and give me something, if you know that's the interaction, if you know that's the transaction, that takes about a split second. There's
right.
really nothing
and people
to
are
ask
going, and people go to the doctors hoping to get a prescription for antidepressants. So
that's exactly right.
That's
this is
it.
A two-way street. That's right. People are abrogating their personal responsibility. They don't want to look at their sadness. They don't want to look at life. They don't want to look at what changes they might have to make to become less sad. They want a pill, just as human beings have wanted scotch and marijuana and cocaine. They want the equivalent of scotch or whatever for what's ailing them, rather than
exactly.
their circumstances.
Exactly. It's just but there's such a, it's a beautiful revelation for me, though, because I'm a nurse, and I've seen this for many, I'm a nurse for almost 30 years, and have seen this scenario, this drama unfold just as we have been discussing it. And I always wondered, and it just, I'm not a medication person. I'm a natural person. You know, I believe in everything being natural. And it just seemed odd that this was something we were all buying. I was supposed to buy. I was really supposed to do that. And I never wanted to. So this is perfect for me. I appreciate that revelation.
And I believe in medication, but it needs to be medication as opposed to a chemical with effects. That's a huge difference. I'll give you a simple example. If you have a raging rhino running at you, you can put it down with a tranquilizer dart. You can create a chemical that knocks it out. But that's not the same as treating what was ailing the rhino. You don't know what was ailing it. You've made no effort to learn what was ailing it. You just have learned how to put it down. And that's very similar to what the chemicals are that are dispensed nowadays. They have effects. And by the way, let's put a big parenthesis here. You, the sufferer, may want those effects. I'm not saying you might not want those effects. If you're in a deep hole, if you're suicidal, you may well want the effects that these chemicals provide. That's just a different transaction from getting medication for an illness.
Right. There has to you have to understand that people do become desperate, and there's a lot of desperation in our society. And I want to bring something else up, but before I do, I just want you to tell our listening audience quickly how we can get a hold of you. You have a www.ericmaisel.com, and I would imagine that you do that you teach and that you hold workshops and such, and that is where they can find that information?
That's exactly right, and folks can also, if they want to chat with me, drop me an email at ericmaisel@hotmail.com, and as you say, that's ericmaisel@hotmail.com.
Oh, that's cool. Getting back to sadness, now, the one of the keys that you have in your book is the artist's relationship with society and the culture, and it would be very difficult, in my opinion, to our relationship with the culture and our relationship with society often runs counter to really being able to be free in the way that you speak and the way that you create and the way that you express. Just because it is very oppressive out there, can you tell? And to me, this is something that I am curious about. I was wondering if you could address that.
Well, there were many different things in what you just said. Let me just pull out one. People don't realize quite to what extent they're scared of speaking up, artists included. One of the proofs of how scared people are of speaking up. Is that the world's number one phobia, you're going to know this, the world's number one phobia is not fear of flying or fear of snakes or fear of bridges or fear of spiders, it's fear of public speaking. Which is pretty darn interesting that human beings are so frightened of even giving a little two-minute talk at their place of business or what have you. So people are basically quite scared of standing up. And being an artist is standing up. It's having an opinion, it's being a leader of sorts, it's being an activist of sorts. It's saying, here's my work, and do with it as you will. Because creative and performing artists are a little unable to recognize the fear level with respect to society, they don't realize the ways in which they sabotage themselves and don't get the work done, especially don't complete work. So many of my clients, so many of creative people start one thing after another and don't complete them. They start with enthusiasm. They do some amount of work, and then the specter of having to show it starts to loom, the specter of having it perhaps criticized or rejected or badmouthed in the marketplace starts to loom. They put it aside, and they move on to the next thing. So Freud said, I don't know that much about artists, but I believe that all cases of blockage is self-censorship. And I think there's a lot to that. There's both psychological self-censorship where you don't even want to know the material for yourself. Maybe you're writing a memoir, but you don't really want to remember what the marriage was like or what the abuse was like or what have you. And then there's that social self-censorship where you're actually a little scared of putting your work out there. It takes courage. It's a risk to put your work out there. People have to decide that they're going to lead as well as follow and actually be an activist and an advocate for their own work if they want to be successful.
Yeah, right. And that gets down to marketing, right?
It absolutely gets down to marketing. Of course, there may be a step before that where you make decisions about doing work that's wanted in the marketplace. It's harder to sell work that isn't wanted than work that is wanted. But once you've done your work, whether it's wanted or not, it's on your shoulders to market it and promote it. And it's on your shoulders. I have a key that's called the empathy key. It's on your shoulders to get a much better sense than most creative folks have of what's going on in the minds of marketplace players. If you don't understand the pressures on a literary agent or on a publisher or on a gallery owner, if you just decide to be completely oblivious about who they really are and what their pressures are, you put yourself in a hole. You mm-hmm. don't realize, for instance, that if a given agent is pressured by receiving hundreds of emails a day, hundreds of queries a day, that means that the subject line of your email has to be special, or else it's just going to get buried in those hundreds of emails. Just by realizing that an agent is under a certain kind of pressure by virtue of the volume of the material she's receiving, that actually gives you a marketplace clue. It gives you a leg up as to what your email has to do. So by being able to empathize better and relate better to marketplace players, you give yourself a better chance, the best chance possible, of having a shot in the marketplace.
Yes, and an understanding of how to do that and to take marketing courses. But so many times marketing takes away from creating, and there has to be a balance there. That's tough.
Well, I think you can't say it that way. I think that's one of those thought formulations that harms you, say that it takes away from. We have two jobs. One doesn't take away from the other. We have two jobs. And we have to do the creating because that's a meaning opportunity, and then we have to do the marketing because that supports our efforts at maintaining meaning. So we have to do both. It's not really that one takes away from the other. We have to do both.
Right.
We don't have to do them in equal measure. We can, create for 2 hours and then send out 3 strategic emails, and maybe that just takes 5 minutes. So it's not that the balance is set in stone. It's not set in stone how much creating you can do and how much marketing you can do. I advise/pester my clients to do 3 things in support of their art business every day. They can be small things or they can be big things. But you need that regularity, you need that attention, you need that intention. You need to be saying, I'm on the side of my work, and here are the things I'm doing that are the proof that I'm on the side of my work.
Right. That makes perfect sense. And instead of being at war with one and at war with the other, just bring them, and well, as you say, we have two jobs.
We have two jobs.
That makes perfect sense. And actually, marketing is very creative.
It can be, especially nowadays. There are so many more options for oddball and interesting marketing and promoting efforts. If folks will only sort of stretch a little bit, stretch their minds, they look for, as you say, the marketing class or the marketing book, rather than sitting down, with a pen and a blank piece of paper and saying, what would be a really interesting, curious, maybe exceptional way to market my CD? What would be interesting? What would be an unusual way to get my cowboy mystery in the hands of a literary agent? Well, since it's a cowboy mystery, maybe I should send 2 or 3 agents some barbecued ribs via UPS and blah, blah, blah. Just sitting there and thinking a little out of the box. Now, your efforts may not work.
Right.
They may be goofy. You may, knock them down the second after you think them. But to be thinking this way, to use a loose word, enjoying it, if you could possibly do that, sort of enjoying inventing interesting marketing and promoting strategies, it's such a more joyful and emotionally healthy way of going about it than white-knuckling it or fighting it, just being opposed to it. That stubborn opposition to marketing just does not help artists.
No, and I believe getting involved in masterminds would be very helpful for people to, brainstorm these ideas that you're referring to, because that helps. It really helps to bounce these ideas off of each other. And
it does. And if you can't, you know, either find or create whole groups, at least you can have one art buddy. It's one of the first things I suggest to clients is most clients feel unsupported. Most artists feel unsupported. And they also, they dream of, you know, creating whole communities of artists. You may know the story that when Van Gogh went to Arles with little money, the little money he had, he spent on buying 12 chairs because he decided he would start a salon. Now, can you see Van Gogh starting a salon? But that's what was in his mind was community. So artists are often thinking about how lovely it would be to have community, and then they look around and discover they don't have it. So if you can't have community, maybe you can have it. But if you can't have it, at least cultivate one art buddy, somebody you respect, somebody who respects you, somebody you can bounce ideas off of, try your pitches out on, do all of the marketing things that we have to do.
So another side of empathy is to get yourself into the shoes of the people you are creating for. So, you know, what are their fears? What are their desires? What are the things that they love? And so the empathy has to go not only to the people you are marketing, not only to, say, as you say, the galleries or where you want to show your work or where you want your work to be received, but also to the people who want to buy your work.
The customers, that's
so
right. And every
yeah.
artist has to make those decisions about how malleable he or she is going to be with respect to the demands of customers. It's really tricky business. You probably know the story, but Arthur Conan Doyle wrote Sherlock Holmes, and it was so popular that that nobody was reading his novels. It overshadowed his novels. So he had the, so to speak, brilliant idea of killing Holmes off. Let me kill Sherlock, and then people will read my other books. Well,
oh my gosh, that's funny.
The outcry was so great that you may remember what happens next in the next Sherlock Holmes story. He's back. Oh, Sherlock didn't die. He was only badly injured. Conan Doyle could not stand the pressure from his own audience to resuscitate Holmes.
Mm-hmm.
And that happens to artists. We try to ignore the marketplace. We try to ignore what our own customers want, which is usually the same thing, only better, which is its own kind of paradox.
Yes.
We try to ignore that. We might want to go in a new direction, and the marketplace, our audience, our customers clamor for us to do the same thing again. It's very hard to negotiate this. It's very hard to make sense of this. One way that famous actors try to make sense of this is to do a popular movie followed by a private non-commercial kind of movie, an idiosyncratic movie followed by a popular movie. They try to strike that balance, and they can get away with it because they're famous.
Yes.
But most other creative people can't manipulate the marketplace in such a way that they give the marketplace what it wants, then they do what they want, then they give the marketplace what it wants. It's a very hard path to walk.
Well, Sir Conan Doyle, I believe, he must have had a bad self-image about the Sherlock Holmes work. But I've read them all, and they are some of the most creative, wonderful things I've ever read. So
no, he wasn't down on them. He was upset that his other work wasn't respected. It's a different thing.
And, yeah, there is,
you
that
know,
is different. Yeah.
You know, if you're creating a body of work and everybody only knows one of your 20 books, you may believe in that book, but you're sad for the other 19 books. It's like somebody praising one of your five kids
children.
And never praising the other four. It's not like you're against the one who's being praised. You're just sad for the other four.
That's right.
You know,
another
so that
point you bring up.
Go ahead.
Another point you bring up is obsession and how I believe this is so important because society and maybe your friends and your parents have told you not to be obsessed by anything. And of course, now obsession is one of those diagnostic things that require an antidepressant for. But you made the distinction that obsession is what we need for our work, not only devotion and passion, but becoming obsessed by something is a good thing as opposed to something that we've all been brought up to believe is bad.
Yeah. I've done a whole book on this, too. The book is called Brainstorm, and the subtitle is, I think, Harnessing the Power of Productive Obsessions. And
well,
it was,
I'm going to buy that one immediately.
Yeah, it was about 130 years ago that one person whose name escapes me at the second, a therapist, defined obsession as an unwanted intrusive thought. Well, as soon as you define obsession as a negative thing, you have no way any longer to talk about anything like productive obsessions or positive obsessions. You've defined the possibility away that an obsession can be good. And that's what we've had for the last 100 years of therapy, is a definitional mandate that obsession be bad. But creative people have known for thousands of years that there are productive obsessions where you really bite into your work and your work is on your mind all the time and you want to get to your work all the time. And that's great.
Mm-hmm.
You have to learn how to manage it. You have to learn how to shut off the productive obsession so you can deal with the rest of life effectively, and that's its own work. But without your brain turning itself over to a project, it's hard for it to go deep into something. Your brain would love to productively obsess about something, but as you say, we have so many injunctions against obsessing that I think we just shut ourselves down the second a really interesting idea arises in us and we think that maybe it would be worth an obsession, so to speak. We shut it right down out of fear of looking crazy or losing control or something. And so an awful lot of people are not turning on their prospective productive obsessions. They're keeping themselves calmer and duller than they need to be.
Right. Well, speaking of having so many books and having people only concentrate on one or two, like you said with about children, you have written so many books. What book do you wish would have more attention paid to it?
Well, I think there are two kinds of answers to that. I think on an importance level, a book like Rethinking Depression, I would love to have more attention paid to it because the issues there are so large. The whole the game, the mental health game, unveiled. So I wish that book were better known, more widely read. But in terms of the books I love of mine that I would like people to read, I have the two little books called A Writer's Paris and A Writer's San Francisco. Both of those are lessons for writers set against the backdrop, in the one case Paris, the other case San Francisco. And I love the essays in those books. They say some of my most interesting things. They may not be the most important books I've done, but sort of artistically, or as, so to speak, objects, I like them the best.
Mm. They seem like simple books of writing in these. Does that have to do with writing in these different places?
It has to do with writing, but it has to do with a lot of other things. They are small essays that do a lot of work. In A Writer's Paris, for instance, I talk about Sartre and inauthenticity and about how Camus was devalued in his own time. So it's about a lot. It's about writers, but it's also about existentialism, meaning-making, and a lot of other things that interest me.
Well, I just ordered your Brainstorm book. I just think, I love to promote other people. So if you're interested in the whole idea of rethinking depression, that to me is one of the most important things I've ever read. And I haven't read all your other books, but I believe that, my gosh, if people realized how they're being manipulated, it would be
one of the real horrors is it's one thing for an adult to sort of buy into it and, collude in it. It's another thing for 5- and 6- and 7-year-olds to be put on antidepressants. They have no choice in the matter. And we have so many children now who are on 3 or 4 or 5 psychiatric medications or psychiatric chemicals. It's really pretty horrible. I was just talking to a young person, a guy in his early 20s, a reporter who was interviewing me, and he said he has a friend who's also in her early 20s who had been on 3 or 4 medications since the age of 5 and just got off them for the first time. It was like, babe in the woods, had never had an emotion before.
Oh,
now in her early 20s
was off?
Now she's having her first emotions. So we're doing a real disservice to our children. It's one thing to do it to ourselves, you know, maybe maybe we have that right to do it to ourselves. I don't really think we have the right to be medicating our kids the way we're currently doing.
Well, not to mention the side effects that occur when you get off of these medicines, even if you are weaning yourself off of them. You can get into heart palpitations that lead into heart attack and stroke. I mean, it's
very
serious.
That's right. And to circle back around to what I said at the beginning, the new DSM is creating many more mental disorders for children, including it's going to be a mental disorder to be an individual. That's what's coming. There's a new defiant personality disorder where if you're a child and you have your own opinions, that's a mental disorder.
That's horrible.
It's horrible, and it's coming. It's right there in print. If anybody wants to go to the DSM-5 discussion page, they'll tell you what they're contemplating. I think it's interesting that they've delayed publication. They may be, as I say, they may be having second thoughts about some of these because the outcry has been so large. But I think in the end, the pocketbook will win, and we'll have many more new mental disorders coming in the next few months.
Yes, the oppositional defiant has been around for a long time, and boy, people love that one. And that was sad to put children into
That's right. They've gone from now you're not just oppositional, you're defiant.
Yeah, I think we should all be defiant. There's reasons to be defiant.
There's reasons to be defiant. There's reasons to be bored. Fortunately, they were going to do an apathy mental disorder, and they skipped that. I don't know why. I'm sure it'll come in the next one. Maybe they just thought they had so many for one time. But
right.
Anything a human being can feel or be or do will be a mental disorder soon enough.
And you do say that in your book, Rethinking Depression. And I really thank people. That is in a very important book. And I will do something with it. I might write a report or we're doing something with it right now. So this is great.
That's right.
But Eric, it was wonderful having you on the show. I really, really loved having you. And it was great finally getting to talk with you.
Great.
And you have a wonderful success with your latest book. And I would think just having successes with your books that people would want to read them all. So that would be my that's what I've heard happens when you write a lot of books. So good luck to
you.
Well,
let's hope so. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Have a wonderful evening.
Thank you. Bye-bye now.
Bye.
Thank you.